begin here with a couple of thought-provoking, rhetorical if-then questions. If God does exist, which obviously I'm speaking to the choir, we believe that he does, but what do we know about him? What has he said or revealed about himself? Why is that important? And then what does that require of us? In other words, like Dan said, we don't just have a bunch of words and scriptures and citations here. There's something that God is revealing to us. If you have a soul, which I believe that you do believe that, how do you know that for certain, though? I mean, beyond you believing that or beyond me telling you that, how do you and I know that we have a soul? Where did that soul come from? Who gave you that soul? And are you answerable for that soul? And who do you answer to? If your soul is morally responsible to God, in the sense that you will be rewarded or punished for what you do in this world, then by what standard are you going to be judged? And how do you know what it means to be good and righteous, or even to be evil and unjust? And if sin does separate the soul from God and keeps us separated eternally, and how in the world can we be reconciled to God? By what process? And how do we know that? And if Jesus is who he said he was, a divine being come to us into flesh as a man, if he came for the purpose in which he stated to reconcile us to God, and if he spoke absolute truth, then what proof do we have of all of that, or do we need those proofs? You see, what so much of the religious world, as well as the secular world, is lacking today is authority. We've got to have authority for what we say. Without proofs, without a reason to believe, and not a reason that is born out of your passionate convictions or mine, or the result of just one church's determination of doctrine or another's. We need to have something that is objective, something that is universal, something that is changeless, something that did not come from us, that tells us what to do and what to believe. And what's the interesting thing about that is that if we can prove that last point that I made, that Jesus is who he said he was and came for the purpose that he stated and spoke absolute truth, if we can believe that or prove that, then it resolves all those other questions that I brought forward. In other words, there is a God, and you do have a soul, and you are responsible for what you do in this life, and you do know what is good as well as what is evil, and sin is real, and it does separate you from God, and can separate you eternally from God, and we can be reconciled to God once separated from him. John chapter 20, verse 31, it says there, John writes, "These things have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." That is one of the starting places for many of my Bible studies. I go right there. And I said, these things have been written for a reason, so that you might believe. Not so that you might believe in Christianity. Not so that you might believe in my church's doctrine. Or so that you might believe in what my congregation teaches. Or you can believe my preacher. Or, you know, what so-and-so says. Rather, so that you can believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Redeemer of prophecy, and he's also the Son of God, the divine being in the flesh. And that is absolutely critical to your salvation. Jesus provides a reason to believe in him. He doesn't just give us a bunch of words. He doesn't just give us a philosophy to ponder over, then quibble over, and to dissect and have arguments over. He didn't just come and give us a religion. He didn't come and give us a good feeling. And thankfully, someone has once said, he didn't come to give us bureaucracy either. But what he came to do is he came to give us a rational, intelligent basis by which we can know what is absolutely true and real and beneficial for us. You say, well, when you get into doctrine, you get into all kinds of technical detail, and yeah, we are going to get into some technical detail at some point here, some measure, but you need that. God saw fit to give you that in order so that you can know that this is not just a good feeling that we're going to pursue here. You can't be made a Christian by a good feeling. You can't have your sins forgiven by a good feeling. You're certainly not going to make it to heaven based on a good feeling. The ancients could know that God existed by observing the physical body, that is, their own human body, and the body of the cosmos, the universe. Romans 1:18 through 20 tells us that. But they could not know God as we know him today because they didn't have what we have today, and that is the Word made flesh. In order to know specific information about what we can't see or what we cannot know beyond the physical, visible three-dimensional realm, we have to have specific revelation and authentic proof, and that's what Jesus provided. It doesn't matter who you talk to. It doesn't matter if they're religious persuasion or even if they say they don't have one. If you ask them anything about God, even if they say they don't believe in God, they've got that from somewhere. In other words, this depiction of God, even if it's incorrect, they pick that up from somewhere. Anyone who knows anything about God, and that includes any of us, if we know anything about God, in order for it to be true and factual, he had to disclose it to us. I don't mean privately, like in a miraculous vision. I mean that he had to reveal that message to us. That is absolutely essential for your salvation. Otherwise, your salvation is basically your opinion. And nobody's going to be saved by their own opinion or a collective of opinions, doesn't matter who has the opinion. Even God does not have opinions. That's another lesson. We've done that before, okay? But you might recall we've talked about that. John chapter 3, verse 1 and 2 says, there's a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews. This man came to Jesus by night and said, Rabbi, which means teacher, we know that you have come from God as a teacher, for no one can do these things that you do unless God is with him. Nicodemus's conclusion was, you are from God because of what you do, because of the proof that you provide, because specifically of the miracles that you perform. Those things confirm who you are, and they confirm that what you say is true, what you teach is true. It cannot be otherwise because God cannot lie, and God is not going to reveal a deception to anybody. There is no darkness in God. And he's not going to give us darkness and peddle it as truth. And that means then that Jesus did come for the purpose that he stated. He did come to become a ransom for us. He can reconcile you to God. It also means that no one else can do what he did. No one else can say what he said. No one else can perform in the way that he performed because he says, no one else can bring you to the Father except me. And I'm saying that pretty pointed here because we are living in a world where there's lots of religions out there that all claim that they have a path to God. In fact, it's called pluralism. You might have heard that word kicked around. That word pluralism basically refers to a belief that there are many paths to God, many paths to heaven, and Jesus so happens to be one of those paths. And if you choose Jesus, well, that's fine for you. But lots of people, good people out there, have chosen other paths, and that's good for them. In the end, we all end up with God. That is not true. And the reason why that's not true is not because I'm saying it or because my church believes that or because all my friends believe that. The reason why that's not true is because Jesus said that's not true. Remember, Jesus has something to say about truth, and he has something to prove what truth is because of what he demonstrated, which is the rest of my lesson. Think of what he said. There's no one coming to the Father except through him. Doesn't matter how popular the religion might be or the movement or the cause or the noble aspirations, the intentions, how sincere someone is. It doesn't matter. In the end, the only way you can get to the Father is through Christ. And instead of looking at that in a negative way, like, well, what about all those good people? What you should say is, the only way that I can be good is to have Christ make me good. And when I'm good with Christ, if you will, then I know where I'm going. And that's the direction I want to go. That's a lot of what we're talking about this whole weekend. I hope that you see that. But we want to talk about these miracles that Jesus performed. There's a lot of misunderstanding, I think, about miracles. A miracle is not just something that happens rarely or even exceptionally in the sense of, you know, it doesn't happen very often, but it has happened, could happen, can be explained. It is not just a rare or unusual natural event, but is something that is beyond any natural or human explanation. That's the definition of a miracle in the biblical context as Jesus performed miracles. That's what he performed, was not things that other people could have done over time, given enough time or given enough opportunity, but rather things that no one can do, unless, of course, God is with him. It is in essence, a temporary interruption of science or nature. It's kind of God sticking his hand into the physical realm, moving things around, adjusting them, changing them however he wants, and then removing his hand and letting things go back to normal. That's a miracle. It's not changing things permanently. It's not a permanent alteration. Dan brought up the idea here, the teaching, of a virgin birth. Well, just because Jesus was born of a virgin doesn't mean that all children from then on are going to be born of virgins. But at that time, what God did, in essence, is he stuck his hand into our world. He really put himself into our world to accomplish something and has done so for good reason, always with a purpose. And then he removed that intervention there so that things could take on the way that they were normally set to do since the creation. And we can look at a miracle in different ways. Something can be miraculous, for example, in its effect, like when Jesus walks on water, when he calms a storm, when he raises someone from the dead. That's an effect, a miraculous effect. We can also look at miraculous speed or timing, like when something happens immediately that is impossible for it to happen immediately. Like when Jesus heals someone who's been paralyzed all his life, or when they're born blind and he makes them see immediately, and there's no need, you know, like in a paralysis situation, there's no need for training, no need for therapy. Leprosy healed at once, healing someone's ear that was cut off with a sword at once, without medicine, without stitches, without time. That's a miracle, because that just cannot happen naturally. There is no way to explain that otherwise. Or it can be a method in which something is done, like casting out demons with a word, as opposed to what the Jews practice, an exorcism, a very elaborate ordeal of chants and incantations and adjurements and everything else, an elaborate ritual, formal exorcism, or causing a fig tree to wither and die with a word. There's a method there. I mean, just with a word, be withered, right? And then watching that tree, just imagine that, seeing that. You say, well, trees do wither over time. Yeah, over time they do, but not when someone just speaks to them. It takes a miracle for that to happen. Or healing a blind man with dirt and spittle. That's a method there that creates a miraculous result. We see Jesus, his whole ministry just really punctuated throughout with all these miracles. Look at some of the passages here. Going throughout all Galilee, it says in Matthew 4, verse 23 and 24, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the gospel, the kingdom, healing every kind of disease, every kind of sickness. The news spread about throughout all Syria about him, and they were brought to him all who were ill, those suffering with various diseases, pains, demoniacs, epileptics, paralytics, and he healed them. It doesn't say that he considered them or that he had stagehands, you know, put up some of the, you know, more or less inconspicuous ones and then, you know, remove the other ones like you see today. He healed them all. And that is powerful because that tells me that this is not someone's take on what happened, but what actually did happen. And when evening came, they brought to him many who were demon-possessed, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were ill. It's a powerful thing to be overtaken by a demon, but it's even more of a powerful thing to have those demons taken out by someone with greater authority than themselves. So think about that. The power and the authority that he produced there, demonstrated in when he cast out those demons. Jesus was going through all the cities and villages, teaching in the synagogues, proclaiming the gospel, the kingdom, healing every kind of disease, every kind of sickness. You say, well, how many different diseases and sickness? Every kind. It doesn't matter how many or what they were, no matter what was brought to him, he healed it. And large crowds came to him, bringing with them those who were lame, crippled, blind, mute, many others, and they laid them down at his feet, and he healed them. This is powerful stuff. It's powerful what he did and the miracles that he performed here. While the sun was setting, all those who had any who were sick with various diseases brought them to him, and laying his hands on each one of them, he was healing them. And at that time he cured many people of disease and afflictions, evil spirits. He gave sight to many who were blind, and he answered and said to them, them being the disciples of John the Baptist, "Go and report to John what you've seen and heard. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised." Who can do all that? Certainly not anyone today. And certainly not all of our self-appointed prophets through history who claim to be something but really are nothing. There's one man who can do that. That is the man with whom God resides, the man who came from God and who has the power of God. But notice, never do we read about any so-called miracles. You know, miracles like we see today, which are basically magic tricks or sleight of hand. But actual, visible, believable signs that cannot be denied by supporters or critics. And I say critics on purpose here because, for example, in John chapter 11, verse 47, after Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, by the way, just simply by speaking, "Come forth," and he raises him from the dead. And it says here the chief priests and Pharisees convened a council and were saying, "What are we doing? For this man is pretending to perform many signs." Oh, it doesn't say that. It actually says he is performing many signs. These are his critics. These are the people that later on in verse 53 say that they are going to get together and plot to kill him. Why? Because they can't do away with what he's doing. They can't explain it. They can't stop him from doing it, so they're just going to get rid of him. That's another lesson, why they would do such a thing. But I want you to see that even his critics could not deny exactly what was happening here. We never read about Jesus performing what so-called faith healers claim to be doing today. Like, "Well, we have heard the testimony of a man, nameless, in some remote village in, pick a country, Africa, India, you know, Australia, Antarctica, you know, wherever, and who, you know, he was missing an arm and a leg and most of his teeth, and then this guru put his hands on him, the arm grew out, the leg grew out, the teeth appeared, and he was healed." You say, "What proof do you have of that?" Well, we don't have any, but we know it happened. You've got nothing there. You know, you've got nothing to support that, but this is kind of what we see. Or we see, stagehands and props and theatrics or camera tricks or CGI. Jesus performed miracles in the public view in the presence of many witnesses without any of those things. And that has to mean something to you. When we're looking at what is true and what is real, we have to look at that and say, well, what is he doing that's different today? What you should be saying is what's being done today is very different than what he was doing. And we never see Jesus using miracles for money, for popularity, for a political campaign, for a fundraiser, to raise a church building or any such thing. Miracles were offered for one reason alone. That was to prove that message that is true. The purpose for miracles is to demonstrate Jesus' otherworldly power and authority so that what he said would be believed and the power that he said he possessed would be believed. We see that over and over. Luke 4, verse 36, after exercising some demons just with a word, it says, "Amazement came upon them all. They began talking with one another, saying, 'What is this message?'" And that's powerful that they say that. They don't say, "What is this miracle? How did he do that?" They say, "What is the message?" Because with authority and power, he commands the unclean spirits and they come out. Someone with that kind of power and that kind of authority must have a very believable message. And then in John chapter 5, verse 36, "The works where the Father has given me to accomplish, the very works that I do, testify about me that the Father has sent me." Remember what Nicodemus said, "We know that you have come from God." Jesus also says, "You know that I have come from God because of the works, the miracles that I am performing. If I didn't come from God, then I couldn't perform those works." The Bible often calls these things signs, and if you think about signs today, signs point to something outside of themselves. The signs aren't the, you know, the thing itself that you're gravitated to. Really, it's the sign points to something outside of itself. It indicates something is present, but you don't go to the sign and stop there. I've used the illustration before. If you're driving northward on I-5 there, you don't get to the sign where it says, "Welcome to Seattle," plop down and say, "Okay, we're here, we're in Seattle, we're at the sign." Okay? You go to the city that the sign indicates is beyond. And the very same thing here. We don't go to the miracles and say, "Wow, if we could only get more miracles performed," because that really wasn't the point. The point was the purpose for which they were performed in the first place. And that's what Hebrews chapter 2, verse 3 and 4 says. After the gospel was at the first spoken through the Lord, it was confirmed to us by those who heard, God also testifying with them, both by signs and wonders and by various miracles and by gifts of the Holy Spirit according to his own will. It comes right out here and says what you and I need to know. What is the purpose for these signs? It is to confirm that message, to confirm that word. We need those signs. Jesus did not come to put on a show or to draw attention to himself, but to preach a message of hope and forgiveness and salvation, to give us a believable message. And once that message was fully delivered, then the signs were no longer needed. Have you noticed that? It's kind of like a building. Once the building is erected, it's all done, they take the scaffolding down. Because the scaffolding there was to build the building. But once the building is done, then the scaffolding is no longer needed. The signs provided a kind of scaffolding, if you will. In fact, one clear indication that the gospel has been fully revealed today is that we are no longer seeing the miracles that originally ushered that gospel in. If the gospel was still in progress and still being revealed, like there were parts of it we didn't know yet and still need to know, and God's still revealing it, we would see signs that would indicate that. Yet, while the signs and miracles provided authenticity and the authority of the message, they never equaled or replaced the message itself, because not a single person has ever been saved because he saw a miracle or because a miracle was performed on him. That person, whoever he or she is, that person needs to obey the message, not just see or experience a miracle. And there's not a single account of anyone in the book of Acts or elsewhere in the New Testament of anyone becoming a Christian because he saw or was the recipient of a miracle. Not a single person. By the way, that's different than what you hear today. Sometimes you hear today people, you know, "Oh, how'd you become a Christian?" "Well, God struck me and, you know, boom," there's some kind of miraculous event that they're describing, they are trying to describe. It's like, that's not how God works. God always works by giving you a message, and then your response to that message really takes it from where it's going to go from there. Jesus healed some people because they believed in him, sought his message, but he never removed their personal responsibility to obey God from them. There's always a personal responsibility involved there. Now, the other two speakers have already said as much. It's important for us to reiterate that point. In John chapter 10, verse 37, 38, some pretty remarkable things that Jesus says, as I understand it. He says in John chapter 10, verse 37, "If I do not do the works of my Father, do not believe me. But if I do them, though you do not believe me, believe the works, so that you may know and understand that the Father is in me and I in the Father." I want you to think about what he's saying there. This is a profound statement. Jesus is admitting that if he didn't do the works, which are the miracles here, if he did not do the works, then what he's saying, in no uncertain terms, is you ought not to listen to me. This is Jesus, the Son of God, saying, if I don't have works that can support what I'm saying, then you ought to write me off as just another Messiah wannabe, okay? Because I am not who I say I am, unless, of course, I do the works. And that changes everything. That's the game changer right there. Because what's necessarily implied in all that, and what he comes out and says here, is because of the miracles, we need to listen to him. We ought to listen to him. Since he provides the works, these convincing proofs, there is no good reason not to believe in him, because his works are signs that his claims are true, that his message is real, that he does have this authority. And there's another aspect to this too here. If you look at Matthew 11, verse 20 through 24, for time's sake, I'll let you read that on your own. But Jesus is condemning those cities which he went to and preached in and performed signs for, and those people did not believe in him, even though he gave them all the proofs that they needed in order to believe in him. And he condemned those cities. And I want you to think about what he's really saying there. If Jesus gives you signs to believe in and you don't believe in them, you say, oh, that's just not good enough for me, or I don't want to believe in the message despite the evidence. Well, what's going to happen to you? Those cities didn't believe and they didn't repent, even though he provided everything necessary to make a rational, intelligent, believable, favorable decision. They had every reason to believe. What that means to us then is that we have a moral responsibility. There needs to be a proper response to these things that we are reading about here. You can't just read those and go, huh, that's interesting. Man here walking on water, healing all the diseases and paralytics and epileptics and demoniacs and doing things that no one else could possibly do in the face of the earth, unless, of course, a divine being was with him. That's interesting. You can't do that. You have to look at that and say, what does this mean? What is this message that comes accompanied with such power? In Acts chapter 17, verse 30 and 31, if you read with me there, this is really the culminating sign that Paul brings up here, as if we haven't had this already before Paul said it, but he makes it very clear. In Acts chapter 17, verse 30, therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, God is now declaring to man that all people everywhere should repent. Not just those cities that Jesus preached to, but men everywhere. You say, well, why is that true? He finishes. He says, because he has fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness through a man, Jesus, whom he has appointed, having furnished proof to all men by raising him from the dead. Someone says, well, I need more proof. You have the proof you need. You have the same proof I do. God has provided the proof of what to believe, a reason to believe. Even though we did not see that resurrection, we have sufficient evidence that it happened. Since that is true, everything else Jesus said is also true. We are morally responsible. We are accountable. Like Paul said, there is a judgment coming. That is true. And every single person in this room is going to stand before God someday, even if you don't believe in it. Even if you don't think that it's going to happen, it's going to happen anyway. Remember, your opinion is really not relevant here. What's important is the truth. And Christians believe in someone who does not merely claim to have power and authority, but who has demonstrated that authority and that power with proofs that only a supernatural God could do. As opposed to the hucksters and charlatans and prophet seekers and frauds and many self-appointed prophets today. Take away Jesus' miracles and the entire gospel falls flat on its face. It's true. We'll concede that. If you take away the miracles, we have no gospel to preach. It cannot be seriously defended. It is just our opinion and nothing else. It's just our religion and nothing else. Because then it would lack credibility, it would lack authenticity, it would lack authority, and we would have no good reason to believe it or expect that any of that would happen. In fact, it's interesting to me, I'm not going to name names here, but one of the largest religions in the world is propagated by a man who claims to be of God, but has absolutely no miraculous defense to his claims whatsoever. And over 1 billion people in the world today are following him. His gospel, so to speak, falls flat because it has no proof. It has no authority. It has no credibility. You say, why are all those people believing in him then? Because they got took. Because they want to believe in something that comes from men instead of listening to what comes from God. Paul makes a similar statement. He says, if Christ was not raised from the dead, if he failed to do what he said he would do, then all our preaching of him and the gospel is in vain. Our faith is in vain. We are still in our sins. We have no hope for the future. We might as well live however we please because we're all going to go to the same place. There's just no hope if that is the case. Thankfully, that is not the case. Our faith in Jesus Christ does not rest on myths. It does not rest on legends or hearsay. It is not something that is a mental crutch. It is not blind faith. It is not a bunch of finger crossing like, I hope I'm right, but I won't know until it's too late, of course. It is not just a religion of mere words and complicated doctrines and convoluted dogmas that people come up with on their own. That's not what God gave to us. What he gave was a message that is real. It is authentic. It is a reason to believe in him. And he proved it, that it is a reasonable message, a rational message that is to be believed. He gave us historical accounts of eyewitnesses who saw, who heard, who felt, who experienced the genuine, authentic, bona fide, corroborated accounts of things that no one could do unless, of course, he was from God. That's what he gave us. Someone says, well, it all depends upon the reliability of the Bible itself. And that is absolutely true. But that also begs the question, if someone's going to take that path, here's some things to consider. If the Bible is not what it says it is, then what is it? And how do you know that? What are you going to gauge that against? What are you going to use as a standard to judge the Bible? If you're going to reject it, what criteria are you going to use to reject it? What proof do you have that this Bible is not what it says it is when you look at the big picture? If you reject biblical authority, then what authority do you accept? I keep posing this question to people who keep telling me, well, the Bible's all written by a man. I say, okay, what authority do you subscribe to? What do you believe in that wasn't written by men? Yes, it's true that men actually penned the words of the Bible. It's not true that this Bible is the product of mere human imagination. It's impossible for that to have happened, given the scope of what is written and the knowledge that is presented and revealed and the time span in which all of this was recorded. It is impossible for a bunch of guys to have gotten together and put this together. But what proof do you have? How do you decide? What provides superior proof to this? What are you going to believe instead of this? And I have yet to have anyone answer that intelligently. Emotionally, yes. Well, I just know what I believe. Well, that's just your emotion. That's your opinion, but that doesn't mean anything. I'm not saying that your feelings and opinions don't mean anything at all. I say what I'm saying is relative to what is being discussed, the disposition of your soul and your future in the afterlife, that is irrelevant, what you opine or what you feel, as much as it is what I think or what I feel. What we need to know is what is true. If Jesus is not the Son of God, as he said he was, as God said that he was, as the apostles preached that he was, as the Bible states that he was, without hesitation, without question, then my question to you, or anyone's question to you, ought to be, well, then who is he? And how do you know that? And what proof do you have? The burden of proof, which means you've got to disprove this first and prove something better. In its place, the burden of proof rests not upon what the Bible teaches. The burden of proof it rests upon the one who rejects Jesus Christ as the Savior of the world. Prove, first of all, that he is not who he claims to be. Secondly, prove what is true, and you better come up with something better than what the Bible came up with. Because you're saying that that's not good enough. You've got to come up with something better. I'm not saying that to be mean or in your face or offensive. I'm just saying it because that's what it comes down to. We've got to have proof. Jesus is making some pretty audacious claims by themselves. They've got to be backed up with a proof that is commensurate with or that measures up to the level of those claims, and he does. On the other hand, some claim that they want to believe, but they think that God needs to perform a miracle just for them, you know, like a private demonstration. And so they'll say, well, I didn't see those miracles, so I don't have to believe like those people had to. You don't have to see something with your own eyes in order to believe with your own heart. God has given you and I reason to believe in his Son, not a personal visitation, not a personal individual performance. Jesus himself said to so-called doubting Thomas, blessed are those who did not see and yet believed. Someone says, well, but if I saw, then I would believe. It's like, did you not just hear what Jesus said? I don't say that to people, but I'm just thinking in my mind, that's what I'm thinking. Did you not just hear? First of all, it's not true. If you did see, then you would believe. It's just not true. None of us saw the creation either, and yet the evidence that is provided inside and outside of the Bible gives us every reason to believe that God is the creator of the world. There's nothing short of a divine, supernatural, all-powerful, all-knowing being that could have put all this together. There's nothing that can explain that except for God being the creator. In fact, Romans 1:20, Paul says, those who say that God is not the creator are without excuse to say so. They have no proof. They can't disprove what they see, and they can't come up with anything better. By the way, evolutionism is not better. It's far deficient. And while any of us would like to see a miracle, and I have to say, in all candor, I would love to see a miracle. The fact of the matter is, I don't have to see a miracle in order to believe. The record of miracles is sufficient. I see all the miracles I need to see right here, and so do you. That's all I need to see. Secondly, God doesn't have to perform according to your expectations. He only needs to provide credible proof for what is universally and absolutely true. He doesn't have to cater to what you want him to do. He's not a puppet. He's a divine being. He's the one speaking with authority. You're the one that's supposed to be listening. I'm the one that's supposed to be receiving and responding rightly to that authority. I can't tell God, well, I'll only believe in you if you perform the way I want you to, because then that puts me in the position of God, to one who challenges God, one who demands that he perform according to Chad, which is pretty arrogant if you think about it. The record of miracles, once again, ought to convince us. That's why we have one gospel and not 7 billion gospels for all the people in the world. Just one gospel is sufficient. And it gets to the next point here. Who are we to tell God what he should or should not do in order to convince us? We walk by faith, not by sight. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 7. We live by faith. Romans chapter 1, verse 17. Someone says, well, it's not fair that some saw and we didn't. It's not about fairness in that sense, like God was, you know, being more fair to them than he is to us. That's really not what it's about. It's about providing a critical proof that is necessary historically for all time, like a courtroom verdict. Like the courtroom verdict has been reached and has been recorded, and you don't need to reassemble the judge, the jury, the prosecutors, the defense, all the witnesses. You don't have to reproduce all those every time someone says, but why should I believe? You just read the court verdict. It's already been substantiated, and it stands for all time. For 2,000 years, people have had opportunity to disprove the Bible. So far, no one's been able to do it. There's lots of people who've claimed this, but they've not come up with any proof that it isn't what it says it is, or that Jesus isn't who he says he is. This series is called The Christ of the Cross. The message of the cross is all about redeeming love, an atoning sacrifice, forgiveness of sins through the blood of Jesus Christ. None of this, however, means anything to us if we can't prove that Jesus is the Christ in the first place. So that's what my lesson is all about, is proving who Jesus is, his nature, as well as the validity or the authenticity of his claims. If we can't prove those things, then it doesn't matter what he claimed. It isn't necessarily true, because he never provided proof substantial enough to make that true. Nicodemus had it right. Rabbi, we know that you have come from God as a teacher. No one can do these things that you do unless God is with him. He's deriving that as a natural, logical, rational conclusion based upon the evidence that has been provided him. He's not just saying, well, you've impressed me. You know, he's not saying that. He's saying that I have no other rational conclusion. You're performing these signs. You must be who you say you are. There's no one else that can do these sort of things unless you are exactly who you claim to be. And that defense, if you will, or that conclusion still stands today. Jesus did not come onto the scene with lots of words, but no substance. Rather, he came onto the scene healing and curing and giving blind people their sight, and giving deaf people their hearing, and giving mobility to those who were paralyzed, and proving who he was by many signs and by many miracles, culminating in exercising the power of God in his resurrection from the dead. But Nicodemus isn't the one on trial here. Jesus really is not on trial either. The miracles are not on trial. What really is on trial is a decision of every person who knows the gospel, reads these accounts for himself, is given these proofs necessary to draw that logical conclusion. Remember what I said, you and I have a moral responsibility to respond rightly to what we read. You can't just read this and be untouched by it. You can't just read this and shrug it off and go, well, that's just what Christians want to believe. You can't just read this and go, well, that's interesting, but. You can't just read that and say, well, I would believe if God would show up and do something for me. You can't just read this and go away the same person. Jesus most certainly did come from God. Indeed, he is the Son of God, not because I or we or Christians in general choose to believe that, but because he has given us a reason to believe that this is true. In fact, I'll even go so far to say is if every Christian in the world suddenly said, you know what, I changed my mind, I don't believe that he's the Son of God, he would still be the same Son of God, he would still be the Christ, he would still be true in everything that he said, because those people would just have an opinion and not the truth. Remember, we can't judge based on mere opinions, and we certainly can't be saved or lost based on mere opinions. So what is your conclusion about Jesus Christ? That's really what this lesson comes down to. What is your conclusion? Not your opinion. You know, with all due respect, I'm really not interested in your opinion about Jesus. What is your conclusion about him based on the evidence that he has provided here? Is he from God or is he not? And if so, if he is from God, then everything he said about your soul, about your moral responsibility to God, about your accountability to God, about the judgment that is going to come, all of that is true because he proved it to be true. And if you say, well, I don't believe he's from God, well, what so convinced you otherwise? What powerful proof is there that convinced you that he is not God, that he is not who he says he was? Who offered or what has offered greater proofs than what he's offered? What else made you conclude something different than what Jesus proved to be true? It's not irrational to believe in miracles, despite what secular scientists, evolutionists, atheists claim. If indeed sufficient evidence does exist to validate that there are miracles, that they are real, it's not irrational to believe in those. I'll tell you what's irrational. It is irrational to entrust your soul to what you think is a miracle, but you don't have proof. That's irrational. I'll tell you something else that's irrational. It is irrational to put your soul in jeopardy by refusing to believe in the God-given miracles when indeed they are proven to you to be true, when you have every evidence to believe that they are true. That's irrational. As for me, I know that Jesus has come from God. That's my personal conviction. It may not be yours. You make your own decision. But I do recommend strongly that you choose wisely. Choose wisely. Because it affects not only what you're doing right now, but it's going to affect where you're going in the hereafter. I want us all to be right with God. This is not a lesson to deter you from making a conclusion or making a decision here. Actually, it's a lesson that's trying to drive you to making the right conclusion and the right decision. And if you need to do that while we are going to stand and sing a song here, if you need